Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. My name is Sarah Scott, and I'm a clinical pharmacy specialist in multiple myeloma at the Winship Cancer Institute of Emory University. Today, I am joined by Emma Uchida, who is a clinical pharmacist practicing in malignant hematology and transplant and cellular therapy at the University of Kentucky in Lexington, Kentucky, as well as Rebecca Gonzalez, who is a clinical pharmacist within the BMT and Cellular Immunotherapy Department at Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida. So welcome to both of you. I'm excited for this conversation today. Our goal for today, we're going to really be talking about siltacabtagene autoleucel, or cilta-cel, which is a CAR T product that's really contributed to dramatic changes in the treatment landscape of relapsed refractory myeloma. And today we really want to highlight and review some of the delayed toxicities that have been seen with cilta-cel, as well as their nuanced management. So just to provide some background on the history of cilta-cel, we first saw FDA approval in the spring of 2022, and this was based on the results of the phase 1-2 CARTITUDE-1 trial. So this trial included 97 patients who were very heavily pretreated with a median of 6 prior lines of therapy. And the trial demonstrated unprecedented overall response rates of about 98%, with responses that actually deepened over time. The most impressive data to come out of this trial was that at the 5-year follow-up, 1/3 of these patients remained alive and progression-free. And this really started the discussion of, could we see a cure in myeloma? The confirmatory phase 3 CARTITUDE-4 trial then compared cilta-cel to investigator choice standard of care regimens in patients in the early relapse setting who had received 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy. The median progression-free survival and overall response rates, including rates of complete response and MRD negativity, were significantly improved with cilta-cel. And at the updated analysis, which had a median follow-up of nearly 3 years, the 30-month PFS was about 60% compared to 25% with the standard of care group. And at this point, we also saw significant improvement with the overall survival. This then led to the approval of cilta-cel for patients with at least 1 prior line of therapy for those who are refractory to lenalidomide. And this time frame really significantly increased the use of cilta-cel in relapsed refractory myeloma. From a toxicity perspective, in both of these trials, the common toxicities that were seen were expected with CAR T, so cytokine release syndrome in about 75 to 95% of the patients, depending on which trial you're looking at. And then immune effector cell-associated neurotoxicity syndrome, or ICANS, in 5 to 20%, again, depending on the trial you're looking at, as well as cytopenias, particularly neutropenia. What started to emerge with the increased use of this were the rare delayed toxicities that include cranial nerve palsies, Parkinsonism, including movement and neurocognitive adverse events, as well as immune effector cell, or IEC-associated enterocolitis. These toxicities are often delayed and require early recognition as well as nuanced management. So again, today we really want to talk through some of our experiences to help provide pharmacists with tools that are needed to approach the care for these patients. We want to kick things off with the cranial nerve palsies. This is the one that I think we see the earliest. So Rebecca, if you want to kind of give us some background here on the incidence of these, when we can expect to see them, and if there's any risk factors or things that we may know patients may be at higher risk for these happening.
Of course. Thanks, Sarah, for that great overview of just cilta-cel in general and the pivotal trials leading up to its overall FDA approval. Certainly, as you mentioned, kind of expansion of cilta-cel use really has highlighted some of these increased recognition of these atypical and early and late non-relapse mortality events. Particularly when we look at cranial nerve palsies, they're kind of a subcomponent of a general class called non-ICANS neurotoxicity. So really, this is kind of a unique spectrum of disorders that can include other neurological complications like movement and neurocognitive issues, Guillain-Barré, peripheral neuropathy. And some of that component here is that cranial nerve palsy aspect. So when you're looking at the overall incidence of these non-ICANS neurotoxicities, both within the clinical trial aspect as well as real-world aspects, it's around 10% of which cranial nerve palsy kind of encompasses up to 4 to 9%. And most often these cranial nerve palsies involve the facial nerve or cranial nerve palsy 7. And it was really most observed in both CARTITUDE 4 clinical trial as well as real world experience reports. The key aspect for cranial nerve palsies as well, patients can present with one cranial nerve involvement. Many of these palsies can actually be bilateral, and patients can present with more than one cranial nerve palsy at a time. Now, the overall onset of cranial nerve palsies is typically at a median of 21 days, but certainly can be beyond 21 days. And this is really based upon some reports in the literature from real-world experience and those reported from some of the CARTITUDE trials. So in general, this is a disorder, basically a class effect for BCMA-directed therapies, essentially due to the on-target effect within the CNS. So we do have BCMA both in the basal ganglia as well as the cranial nerves. So in contrast to some cranial nerve impingement that can happen, this is more of a temporal, like local inflammation that can happen from the CAR T migrating to those cranial nerve regions. So the good news is it appears to be a BCMA specific target effect. So although the overall incidences have been higher in cilta-cel, it's really kind of driven by the dual BCMA binding effects of the structure of cilta-cel in comparison to ide-cel, which only has one BCMA targeted antigen. So overall, when we look at kind of the overall incidences and any particular risk factors that are associated with this, similar to some of our other toxicities like CRS and ICANS, having a higher baseline IL-6 level and increased tumor burden have consistently kind of shown patients are at higher risk for developing this particular toxicity. Additionally, and I think something that will kind of encompass all of these atypical toxicities is kind of an increased recognition of higher peak ALC within the first 3 weeks post-CAR T, kind of driving some of these inflammatory responses. I think one of the key aspects in terms of management is that, you know, unlike some other disorders, cranial nerve palsies are very responsive to corticosteroids, as well as the introduction of IVIG supplementation as well. So this is certainly something from a pharmacist perspective that early recognition and intervention can be critical, especially collaborating with some of our other consultative services like neurology. In terms of aspects and treatment, we actually do have some recommendations that were provided by EBMT to kind of help harmonize and provide some guidance as far as best practices for managing these atypical toxicities. Being said, in terms of steroids and IVIG supplementation, I know a lot of institutions have their own kind of standards. But looking through the literature and kind of existing approaches, certainly initial therapy with dexamethasone can be utilized. Here at Moffitt, we do a total of 24 to 72 hours of Dex 10 every 10 milligrams every 6 hours, and then transition over to oral prednisone with an overall goal to be off corticosteroids in general after 2 to 3 weeks, depending on responsiveness. We also provide IVIG supplementation for a total of 2 grams per kilo that we typically divide over 2 days. And for those that are at risk for infusion-related reactions, we can certainly extend it out for longer duration over 2 to 5 days. And then this kind of, you know, in general, a lot of the things that we do for CAR T are extrapolated based off of institutional practices in collaboration with some consortiums. And so based on 2 different registries, both from International Myeloma Foundation, as well as the US Myeloma Consortium, they also really kind of support that cranial nerve palsies are very steroid responsive. And so usually we can see resolution within around 11 days and complete response within 2 months. So it is really promising as far as our recognition of in management, I think is a little more data-driven than some of our other challenges that we may have for some of our other atypical toxicities. So I don't know, Sarah and Emma, like, do you feel like steroid responsiveness is certainly something that you've seen with cranial nerve palsies at your institution?
Yeah, I've been pretty fortunate so far, knock on wood, at the University of Kentucky, where I have not seen any of these cranial nerve palsies. The fact that it is steroid responsive based on the real world studies that are out there, definitely encouraging. So far I've been lucky to not have to see any of this in our patients.
Yeah, I would agree with the steroid responsiveness. We have seen good results with steroids, as you kind of alluded to. Everyone sort of has different approaches to this. And I think the consortium publications, as well as the new guidance we have, is helping to kind of streamline that. There is always the argument of, is it time or is it the steroids? But in patients where we don't initiate steroids sooner, it does seem to take longer to resolve. So I think that speaks to the importance of the management. Another question that I sort of had for you guys, it's posed to me a lot when these come up, is do your institutions initiate valacyclovir or acyclovir, if that's your institutional preference?
So most of our patients at this point in time are already on HSV prophylaxis to begin with. So they just remain on, our go-to is acyclovir for HSV prophylaxis. So our patients are typically continued on this therapy for up to a year to provide coverage up until they can actually receive vaccination for HSV and VZV.
Yeah, we're the same, where we just maintain their prophylaxis. I think the question that comes to us is coming from, is this some sort of herpes zoster infection? And I think because we know my rationale for not initiating like treatment doses of any sort of valacyclovir, acyclovir, is that we have an idea or a really good educated guess of where this palsy is coming from. So we know the pathophysiology of it. And I think many of us would agree that the valacyclovir treatment dose is probably not going to be providing any benefit, at least. So just curious, I hear mixed things when I talk about this with others.
Yeah, we also, before kind of initiating any therapy, we do always have patients receive our neurology team does come for a consult for a patient. And then we typically will do an MRI, an LP, to kind of rule out potential HHV6 or other causes, typically for this before initiating therapy. So I think this also kind of helps out to rule out other causes, especially infection related, as you mentioned, just because viral causes certainly can be on the differential.
Yeah, I think the interdisciplinary management of all three of these is something that's very important. So I think, as we sort of talked about, the cranial nerve palsies, they happen just kind of a TLDR, a median onset's about 3 weeks after cell infusion. Steroid responsive, also consideration for high dose of IVIG, and typically will resolve within a couple of months. The other non-ICANN serotoxicity that I think is important, and for me at least, a lot more challenging for management, is the Parkinsonism. So if Emma, if you don't mind kind of also providing some information on sharing with us your knowledge of like the incidence of this, what the onset looks like, and if there's any associated risk factors for this one.
Absolutely. So similar to the nerve palsies we just talked about, are movement and neurocognitive treatment emergent toxicities, which you might see called MNTs, are another subset of this non-ICANS neurotoxicity. You might also see it referred to as an IEC-associated Parkinsonism. It tends to occur in about 5% of patients that are receiving the BCMA-targeted CAR T-cell therapies, again, mostly with those patients that are treated with cilta-cel, for the reasons that Becca went over earlier with the cranial nerve palsies. Although some of the symptoms of this could overlap with ICANS, really these MNT symptoms typically exhibit a delayed onset well after the resolution of CRS and ICANS. So the median onset of these symptoms is around 1 month in reported cases, but it has a pretty broad range. It can be anywhere, maybe up to 3 months after CAR T cell therapy. The symptoms can vary. It could include aspects of movement disorders, such as handwriting changes, tremors, some speech disturbances, but it could also include cognitive impairment symptoms. So if you have a patient that's starting to exhibit memory issues, or maybe they're starting to have worsening inattention, that could be a sign of this MNT. And the other thing that's a little more subtle is personality changes. So if you notice someone having decreased facial expressions, or if they have, you know, a flat affect when they didn't have one before, that could be a sign of this IUC Parkinsonism. As far as patients that are at higher risk for getting it, there are cases of MNT that are linked to high CAR T cell expansion within the peripheral blood and CSF. So a lot of the risk factors are pretty similar to what Becca went over with our cranial nerve palsies. But in a report of patients from the CARTITUDE 1 study who developed some of these symptoms, it was in patients that had the higher tumor burden, had grade 2 or higher CRS or ICANS, and did have that high CAR T cell expansion or persistence. In patients that developed MNT, they also had patients that had a higher absolute lymphocyte count, which will be a common theme, as mentioned already. And they also had higher absolute CD4 T cells and CAR T cells, even on days 14, 21, and 28 post-cilta-cel infusion. These patients did have those higher inflammatory markers as well, such as peak IL-6 and interferon gamma, that were higher compared to patients that didn't experience an MNT. There was also a retrospective evaluation done by the IMWG group that looked at patients that developed IEC Parkinsonism and found that these patients, again, just reiterated the fact that they had greater inflammatory response seen with CRS, elevated absolute lymphocyte count, CRP, and ferritin compared to those, even those who developed cranial nerve palsies. So really some things to try and reduce the risk of these MNTs is to try and optimize the bridging therapy before CAR T cell infusion, trying to reduce that tumor burden, trying to provide earlier interventions for CRS and ICANS in patients that were to develop them, and increase the monitoring for neurological complications even beyond that initial 14-day period where we might be monitoring them more closely. So just like with the cranial nerve palsies, anytime we have a patient where we're concerned about some of these neurological effects, we should try and consult our neurology teams to exclude alternative diagnoses. We want to be monitoring those absolute lymphocyte counts. And interestingly, these patients typically have normal dopamine active transporter or DAT scans whenever you are doing some imaging for them. We have seen that, you know, short courses of levodopa or carbidopa could be tried, but they don't seem to have a significant response if it is this IEC-associated Parkinsonism. So kind of segue into that with possible treatment options. Becca, would you be able to weigh in on what you've seen used for management in these patients?
Of course. I think one of the challenges for IEC-associated Parkinsonianism is that, as you mentioned, you know, they may have a normal DAT scan. They may have variable imaging from an MRI or a PET scan. And so certainly this is a disorder that typically patients don't have that loss of dopaminergic neurons, but they are actually presenting like they have typical Parkinsonian disease. And as you mentioned, you know, use of short courses of levodopa, carbidopa historically was something that we initially did up front, but now with our kind of better understanding that this is not necessarily a dopaminergic disorder, so we've typically kind of transitioned to something very similar to cranial nerve palsies with initiation of corticosteroids. However, one of the key aspects that we have noticed specifically for these disorders is unlike cranial nerve palsy, they aren't as steroid responsive. So we typically will initiate corticosteroids for a short course, typically within the first 24 to 48 hours, and additional support with high-dose IVIG, just like cranial nerve palsies. But typically, these patients may need additional escalation of therapy. I think one of the key aspects, and you had mentioned it earlier, is that patients with this Parkinsonian-like disorder actually do have high levels of CAR T expansion. And so patients typically, in the absence of being essentially lymphopenic or a LP's done and they don't really have any CAR T cells or lymphocytes present, typically we'll maybe choose something more systemic in order to treat their Parkinsonian disorder. Whereas those patients that we do an LP and they do show very high lymphocytes, we actually will initiate targeted therapy utilizing intrathecal chemotherapy. Now, the literature has many case reports, including use of doublet or triplet chemotherapy with cytarabine, methotrexate, and hydrocortisone, as well as kind of second-line options with thiotepa. So our kind of gold standard, or at least in, for now, given our experience, is to offer the opportunity for those patients who have CNS lymphocytosis administration of IT chemo. We do triplet chemotherapy at least twice a week for the first 2 weeks and then kind of assess for symptom resolution. I don't know, do you all typically will upgrade patients intrathecal chemotherapy if they do show CNS lymphocytosis on their LP?
Yeah, we've been doing that at our institution as well. We have not tried thiotepa, but we have been doing triplet therapy for patients, like you said, at the cadence of twice weekly, usually until clearance. Another, we are collaborating with a physician scientist who can actually identify the CARs within the CSF. And so we are tracking that number as well as just the lymphocytes overall. So we're not necessarily waiting for clearance of that number, but with the lymphocytes, but thiotepa is definitely interesting, but we've tried the IT as well for these patients.
Awesome. The only other thing that we have utilized, as I mentioned, if they don't have that CNS lymphocytosis, is actually doing more T-cell directed systemic therapy, including hydrocyclophosphamide. Now, the doses in the literature are kind of highly variable, anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams per meter squared. Typically, we'll start at 1,000 milligrams per meter squared and then redose as needed based on any clinical improvement. I think something very unique that has increased recognition in the literature is the use of low-dose ruxolitinib in patients who are refractory to second-line therapy. And what's really unique is this may extend to some of our other atypical toxicities that we see post-cilta-cel. And so the doses are typically around 5 to 10 milligrams, either twice daily or once daily, depending on kind of the overall clinical picture. But I don't know if you have all utilized ruxolitinib for this particular disorder or the use of high-dose cyclophosphamide.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the ruxolitinib. I would say in our cases in which we've initiated this early have been our best outcomes. And so this has become a favorite at our institution. The question from pharmacy is always insurance authorization, which is challenging. But because there's really no clinical trials in this space, there's we can use those case reports. And I've been lucky most of the time in getting this approved. So we've used that. The cyclophosphamide, we try to reserve for everything else if everything else has failed. We've had a couple of incidences where patients just never recover their counts after that high dose of cyclophosphamide. And we've just seen kind of poor outcomes from not necessary myeloma-related mortality, but other complications. And so we try to reserve that for like a last-ditch effort.
Yeah, I agree. Getting insurance authorization for off-label use certainly is challenging. And I think that definitely is a role for a pharmacist to kind of assist the team in kind of navigating that letter of medical necessity. And I hope that increasing recognition of this use and reported literature can kind of help supplement our need to add this as an opportunity to treat these patients, because realistically, we don't have any really, really good, consistent options.
Yeah, I totally agree. And the other kind of, I guess, on the other end of this is thinking about, we've alluded to this before, but the absolute lymphocyte count and the role in watching that and any mitigation strategies there. And I know there's emerging data really looking at this lymphocyte count and maybe providing thresholds. So at our institution, we are using a threshold of 3,000 within the first couple of weeks where we would initiate dexamethasone as, like, I don't know if I'd call it primary prophylaxis, but to really lower that ALC and the goal of preventing these non-ICANS neurotoxicities and delayed events. So how are you all approaching this at your institution? Are you using any other tools to mitigate these risks once the CAR-T is administered?
So Sarah, at our institution, we currently also utilize kind of a 3,000 marker for ALC within the first 3 weeks, kind of as a surrogate marker for toxicities. I think there is increasing recognition in the literature that an ALC anywhere between 2,500 to 3,000 within the first 3 weeks certainly is an indicator of some of these atypical toxicities. So we do a suppressive type of dex. Administered essentially up to 3 days for the first go around, and then kind of daily assessments thereafter. We certainly have had some patients that, despite suppressive dex, continue to have that ALC rise, and we have integrated cyclophosphamide kind of like an as-needed approach, anywhere from a flat dose of 500 to 1,000 from the R-squared. And certainly provider-specific, patient-specific, but we've definitely seen some exponential rises from 3,000 to 15,000 in one day. So certainly something that we definitely monitor patients very closely. And I think it's really important to kind of recognize that with the REMS changes, you know, we typically don't keep these patients on site for 30 days, although, you know, these patients can have this ALC rise, you know, 20 days out from CAR-T. So certainly something that to continue to monitor beyond just the acute toxicities is an important thing to denote for this.
Yeah, Emma, or I agree. We're doing similar things, and I've seen very, very rapid expansion. It's kind of wild how quickly it can happen. Emma, how are you all managing this at Kentucky?
Yeah, right. In current state, we're monitoring the absolute lymphocyte count, but we aren't instituting any suppressive dexamethasone strategies for patients that do have that rise up above 3,000. These are patients, though, where we might discuss bringing them back more frequently. Like you said, now without the REMS program, this isn't something where we keep them for the full 30 days. We have a lot of patients who are referred from rural community centers. So rather than, you know, sending them back to their local oncologists and following them less frequently, you know, patients that we had seen increased absolute lymphocyte count, we would probably watch a little bit more closely, have more communication with that local oncologist when it did come time for them to be referred back, especially since some of these side effects can occur so much later on. But right now, we aren't using suppressive dexamethasone in our patients.
Yeah, I think you bring up a really good point that I think will also be important with the last toxicity with the colitis that we'll talk about, is the identification of these and having local oncologists as well as community pharmacy partners being able to identify some of these symptoms and identify some of these risk factors for intervention. So there aren't delays in getting them back to the academic center or delays in management. Anybody can give dex for 3 days. So I think helping provide that guidance to local partners is super important. So I think that will help us transition into the third and final kind of delayed toxicity. And this is to me, the most severe, the one we've seen the worst outcomes with, and that's the immune effector cell enterocolitis. So, Emma, if you don't mind kind of sharing with us again some of the background on this, then we can talk about management for this one and all of its complications.
Yes. So IEC colitis is definitely something we are learning a lot more about in the recent years. This is something that wasn't explicitly reported in any of the initial CARTITUDE trial publications. But since then, there's been a pooled analysis of patients across the CARTITUDE studies that was presented at ASCO this year that showed that in 483 patients that they looked at, six patients or 1.2% of patients did demonstrate the clinical picture of IEC colitis. There have been other retrospective multi-center reviews which do show an incidence of around 3 to 4%. But I think it's important to note that since this is rare and it's kind of a heterogeneous complication, we don't know the true incidence since it's likely underreported in the literature. As far as the median onset goes, this is another one that's going to be quite a while after the CAR T cell therapy itself. Appears to be about 1 to 3 months after CAR T cell infusion. But again, it could range even to over 6 months after therapy when this could occur. I think an interesting thing to note is that in biopsies that were done in patients with IEC colitis, histologic damage didn't really indicate that it was CAR T associated as far as CAR T cells being found in the pathology. But it looks like it's more of a reactive mechanism involving plasma cell depletion and immune dysregulation. Some risk factors that we know of course, again, it's mostly associated with our BCMA-targeted therapy, and it's most notably, of course, with our cilta-cel. There was a retrospective case control analysis that looked at differences between patients that did and did not have IEC colitis. And they found that patients that did have IEC colitis were more likely to have received alkylator-based therapy within 3 months prior to the CAR T cell therapy. And patients who were scored higher or high risk on the CAR hematotox scoring system also were more likely to have IEC colitis. They also looked at some of the continuous variables for patients who developed IEC colitis and found that they overall had a lower median hemoglobin and they had higher serum ferritin prior to lymphodepleting chemotherapy. And even 1 month post-infusion, patients with IEC colitis had higher serum ferritin in their labs as well. So as we kind of move into what this actually looks like for our patients, Becca, do you mind to let us know maybe how these patients tend to present and how they are ultimately diagnosed?
Of course, Emma. So I think one of the more particular challenging aspects of it is, as you mentioned, kind of the onset is much more delayed than whatever our typical toxicities. So typically our patients may show up having this kind of late onset, like non-infectious type diarrhea. They may or may not have any abdominal pain, in which I think this is why our incidences reported in the literature are so rare, just because these are very non-specific symptoms. And so a lot of times, you know, patients may have weight loss and some type of inflammatory enterocolitis, either due to a recent infection. We certainly have had a few patients that presented who had positive norovirus, but our confirmatory PCR showed norovirus negativity. So it is quite challenging in that regard. A lot of our patients actually have come from other facilities that were admitted. And then, you know, unfortunately, they had received antibiotics, therapies to target C. diff, even though they were C. diff negative. And then they typically transition over to our institution. I think one of the key aspects, you know, for overall diagnostics and kind of assessments is really trying to rule out other potential causes that may be triggering this. And certainly infectious complications is one of them. So typically from a presentation perspective, because non-bloody diarrhea is very non-specific, we do encourage consulting our infectious disease team as well as our GI team as well, just to kind of get a collaborative approach when we're looking at these patients. I think, you know, going from the transplant side of things, we kind of have that graft versus host disease lens and doing the proper workup. So typically we want to try to rule out other potential causes. So is this a drug-induced thing, an infection-related thing? So a lot of our patients do undergo endoscopy procedures, EGD or FlexSig, to kind of rule out any potential viral-induced things or other potential infection-related causes. A lot of these patients, because they're so far out, may actually be on stool softeners or laxatives. So certainly kind of holding medications is kind of on the low end of the kind of the basic thing that we do. We also send out like GI panel and those type of things as well for infection related causes. But certainly with these patients, a lot of times they may have had a history of other atypical toxicities and have been on immunosuppressive therapy. So it's always really important to kind of rule out CMV or adenovirus as well, because those things can potentially pop up even in these patients. So you had mentioned kind of evaluating, you know, with the potential role for CARs being within the GI tract. So certain centers are able to do what's called a multiplex immunofluorescence. Not every center can do it, but essentially that allows the ability to see if CARs are actually infiltrating that area. So this actually has historically been a send-out test for us. So we also do recommend kind of getting that additional testing done if it's possible. So biopsies are very important, just like graft versus host disease, to just essentially rule out every other potential cause. I don't know, at your centers, do you guys typically send out those other additional tests or have pathology take a look to see if there's other potential causes for it?
Yeah, when our few cases that we've had pathology, we've done biopsies in all of them. And like you sort of alluded to, is it does look a little bit like graft versus host disease. And so that's kind of guided our management, which you know, we can talk about in a second. But we've also seen T-cell infiltration, not just CARs, but T-cell infiltration. And so kind of alluding to that, not quite secondary malignancy, but like a lymphoproliferative disorder that we're seeing within the GI tract. I believe with the samples, we've used that same physician scientist lab to look for CARs that we're using for the CSF. But the two most common things that we're seeing is the inflammation and then the T cell infiltration in select patients.
We have been, again, pretty lucky so far. We haven't had a patient that has exhibited IEC colitis. It's always on our radar, and we had a patient where we were concerned about it, but we've been able to identify alternative causes. So we haven't had a patient where we've ended up having to do an endoscopic evaluation yet. We've done like a CT and unfortunately had a patient that had recurrence of their disease with extramedullary sites within the colon, which kind of explained their presentation a few months after CAR-T, but not IEC colitis.
And I think amongst like everyone, it's kind of the debate. It looks kind of like graft versus host disease, but can present kind of like an immune checkpoint inhibitor induced colitis, or it could be some underlying T cell lymphoproliferative disorder. So I think definitely, hopefully, in the next couple months, we'll have better answers or additional literature to kind of support what route to kind of take. And I believe most of our management is really kind of extrapolated from other immune-mediated colitis disorders.
Yeah, I would agree with that. From our perspective, we, you know, just like anything else, we're initiating steroids. And I think the questions we run into is when do we initiate those and how long do we keep them? I think in a couple of patients, we maybe waited too long while the workup was pending. You know, these were early cases where this was less discussed, you know, a couple of years ago. And so we maybe delayed and started them too late. And then if they're not effective, from my experience, they're either going to work quick or they're not. And so kind of figuring out how to taper them off and where to go next. We also will typically, when we initiate the steroid, give kind of the high-dose IVIG, similar to the Parkinsonism. But curious what y'all's approach is to initiating the steroid, the timing of that, and how long you would keep it on.
So we also kind of go the steroid route, and I think that is our theme for these atypical toxicities. Steroids can have some potential benefit, but I feel like just like Parkinsonianism, steroids are good temporally, but typically they're not going to completely resolve these symptoms, especially if this patient truly does have IEC colitis. I think one thing that we tried to implement early on is making a patient completely NPO for at least 48 to 72 hours while we initiate corticosteroids. So we can essentially give kind of the best chance for these steroids to work. We've kind of extrapolated from our graft versus host disease kind of training is just typically doing a mg per kg of steroids for about 7 days. And after 7 days, then kind of moving on to additional therapies. But after treating, we've had a total of 6 patients thus far with this disorder. And kind of what we've learned is steroids are good temporally, but we are always kind of looking to see what additional therapies we can add. And really, that's driven based upon how severe this patient is presenting. Typically, those that do have like a CTC grade of severe grade of diarrhea will actually kind of escalate therapies earlier on with concurrent steroids. And especially those are the ones that have like pneumatosis on presentation when they're doing their CT. We also do the IVIG route as well. I think we can't go wrong, at least giving them some support there. But yeah, steroids usually will give about a 7-day period in general. And then for those that do have more severe disease, we are kind of looking in our armamentarium for other agents to pull in sooner than later. Emma, is that the same for you guys as well for your kind of algorithm? I know you haven't had anybody yet, but.
Yeah, we haven't had anybody yet, but I think that if we were to come across this situation, definitely corticosteroids first. But if we don't see a response after, you know, a week or so, I think it makes sense. We would use some GI biologics, but even before that, utilizing IVIG to kind of provide some support as well.
Yeah, agreed. And I think there are a couple of guidance documents that have come out surrounding this. I just think because of its high mortality rate, everyone is very worried and we want to get answers quickly to how to accurately manage this. So, but those are based on very small case series. I think the one I read from this year was 9 patients. So for us, you know, the steroids, how long we keep them seems shorter course. Is more guidance. If it's not working, we probably need something else. And as you alluded to, Becca, even if it does work, it's very temporary. So we typically will reach for biologics next. I think from a formulary perspective, we typically do infliximab and save reserve vedolizumab as more of a second option after the infliximab. But we are often doing infliximab along with ruxolitinib. And I don't know if that's the right or the wrong thing to be doing, but part of that is working on getting that ruxolitinib authorization and hoping that that will be more the once they are discharged from the hospital, we can continue that. But curious kind of what your algorithm is beyond that first line that you guys have done with your 6 patients at Moffitt.
Yeah, so our initial algorithm did have kind of our second go-to of having those GI biologics, and we have both infliximab and vedolizumab. On formulary, the ability to utilize it. Now, preference is really provider specific, but I would say initially we did provide patients with infliximab up front. But similar to your institution, we've actually integrated our ruxolitinib kind of into our algorithm a little bit earlier on, and certainly sending a prescription to get overall insurance coverage, again, because we know it might be challenging for this off-label use. I can say that we have been able to get access to this medication through patients' insurance. As you mentioned, you know, this has very high mortality, so we've certainly been able to do a lot more encouraging via the letter of medical necessity specifically for this, as well as the most recent kind of publication regarding kind of stepwise approach and showing the utility of ruxolitinib, particularly for these patients. So we actually kind of skip the biologic therapies, go to ruxolitinib. And then in more severe cases, we've actually integrated cyclosporin in combination with ruxolitinib. And we've actually had success with that combination, just so we can actually essentially be able to monitor the degree of immunosuppression and be able to use very low doses of ruxolitinib, especially when the patient's GI tract is tenuous and at risk for bleeding complications.
You know, I appreciate you highlighting the bleeding complications. We've run into that, especially in patients who are experiencing the concurrent delayed cytopenias that occur with these products. And managing the thrombocytopenia is already challenging, and then adding on ruxolitinib can make it more challenging. So that's something we've been navigating with a couple patients recently as well. So I think this has been a very wonderful conversation. It's really wonderful to hear different experiences with these very unique and nuanced toxicities. So just want to kind of pose to both of you to wrap things up. Any final thoughts or any kind of future considerations and things that you guys are looking for as we move to the future in the management of these toxicities?
Yeah, I think.
Go ahead.
So I think something that we'll probably see moving forward in the next few years is utilizing kind of a risk adapted approach, especially for these particular agents that are associated with these unique toxicities. I think something that has encompassed from the leukemia lymphoma perspective, utilizing CAR hematotox as a potential method to risk stratify, do early intervention or prophylactic strategies to try to reduce some of these incidences for these more severe toxicities. And I know Emma had described some of the other kind of proactive measures that we can do to reduce some of these toxicities. However, you know, the CAR hematotox a lot of times is utilized right before lymphodepletion. So at that time, we really don't have any additional interventions we can do for patients. However, there is increased recognition in utilizing a SVOPE score. So this actually looks at patients' risk at the time of apheresis and looks at pre-apheresis risk factors. So I think this is something, especially for BCMA-directed therapies, that can be very positive in helping kind of direct who's at risk. What interventions can we do proactively just to kind of reduce some of these toxicities, knowing that ALC is a likely driver of all of these atypical toxicities?
Yeah, I agree with everything Becca just said. I think that as we get more guidance on some of these risk-adapted approaches and, you know, considering some things like suppressive dexamethasone, you know, based on ALC or maybe even CAR hematotox, I think it'll be great to see how we can improve really or decrease the incidence of this overall, but making sure again to provide education opportunities kind of like this, just to make sure that when we do have these patients that are presenting locally long after their CAR T cell therapies, ensuring that we can identify these early and start treatment for any of these side effects earlier as well and provide interventions for those, I think will be helpful. I think it'll be interesting to see, you know, in some of the newer trials that are ongoing with like CARTITUDE 6, how this might look, especially using it in earlier line therapy, and if that's going to change, you know, anything about how we're going to be managing these patients going forward as well to try and decrease their risk of some of these delayed toxicities.
Yeah, I really appreciate both of your career. I think the use of this is not going to slow down. We may see new products come to market, but like you mentioned, Emma, with CARTITUDE 6 and other trials, we may see this used even earlier for patients. And unclear at this point how that alters the toxicity profile. And it's definitely going to expand the use of this if it shows benefit. And so I think a lot to come in the future, which is very exciting for our patients with myeloma, but also will pose additional challenges for us as providers. So again, I want to thank you both for your expertise, and thank you for your time today.